Bad Quaker Podcast, where liberty is our mission. Today is Friday, October 11th, 2013. This is podcast number 354, and my name is Ben Stone. Now, today, I'm going back and visiting the Beyond Civil Disobedience series. This will be Beyond Civil Disobedience Part 5. That'll be today's podcast. And I want to start out by giving a real quick review of some of the foundational things that I laid down in the first four parts of this series. And as I've said in the other series, if you haven't heard the first four parts, then seriously, don't listen to this one because it may not make any sense to you at all. Go back and just go to badquaker.com. In the search, there's a search section off in the upper right-hand corner of the page. Put in the words Beyond Civil Disobedience, and it'll pull up the list for you of the previous four podcasts on this topic. So listen to those in sequence first before you listen to this one. So again, I want to emphasize the four things in order that should be the most important for anarchists to do. Number one is educate people on the evils of government. This is the moral argument. This is where we have the high ground. That should be the number one goal of an anarchist, is to educate people on the evils of government. Number two, second most important, is point out the failures of government when governments fail to do the things that they claim the exclusive right to do. This is the practical argument. An example of that would be, oh, well, the government provides the roads. Without the government, who would provide the roads? No, government roads kill about 30 to 40,000 Americans every single year. Government is failing at the one thing that they claim most of almost anything else that they do, and they fail at it. Oh, but governments keep us safe from foreigners. Oh, and just the opposite. Government aggression is why we have problems with other people in other countries. Okay, so point number one being educate people on the evils of government, the moral argument. Point number two, point out the failures of government when government fails to do the things that they claim the exclusive right to do. This is the practical argument. Number three, third in importance, make money from the failures of government. Drain government. Funnel some of that money back into our cause. And number four, most important, the least important of all four of these, assist the government in its path of self-destruction. We don't want to poke the dragon. We want to slowly poison his soup. Now, as I've said before in this series, government is not the enemy of the anarchist. The religion of the state is the enemy of the anarchist, because it's faith in the state that justifies government. In the eyes of people in general, and in the eyes of the people in government who are actually acting out those evils of government. It's that faith, it's that religious adherence to the idea that government is good. That's statism. That's that faith in the state. And that's our enemy, not individual people in government. It's that faith. Our religion, our war is a war against a religion, the religion of statism. And now I want to play the I told you so game. Okay? And not a lot of people are being loud about this. Not a lot of people are talking about it. But I kind of have to be. On Monday, June 3rd, 2013, in podcast number 323, titled Beyond Civil Disobedience Part 3, I gave advice that would have kept Adam Kokesh from being arrested on July 9th. Again, that was June 3rd in podcast number 323, Beyond Civil Disobedience, Part 3 in this series. And what I said at that time was I had said to drive a clean car, be unencumbered, give them no reason, no grounds to harass you. And I said to remember the lesson of Judy, I think it's Judy Berry, I think that's how you pronounce her name, and her car bombing. And this was with Earth First. It was years ago. The FBI actually had stooges that worked for a different protest organization. The FBI had stooges plant a bomb under the seat of her car. And then when the bomb exploded and almost killed her, they arrested her and charged her with carrying the bomb. And, of course, later all the charges were dropped because there was no evidence of this. It was very clear from the evidence that it had been planted, that it didn't belong to her, and then it was an attempt to kill her. Well, this is what government does. If government will get stooges, and the FBI does this kind of thing all the time, if the government will get stooges to plant a bomb under a woman's seat because she's an activist that's actually threatening, her cause was actually threatening to make changes in the way logging was being done in Northern California. So her organization was a threat not only to government, to the established government, but it was also a threat to some large corporations. So if government would do that to her, what would they do to the rest of us? Would they come into your house and plant something in your house and then arrest you for it? Of course they will. Of course they would. Of course they have. So in that podcast back on June 3rd, I said to avoid a frontal attack. Never let your enemy know that you are his enemy. And then on June 7th in podcast number 324 titled Beyond Civil Disobedience Part 4, a full month before Adam's house was raided, I said this: no matter the activity, always weigh the cost. If you can't pay the piper, don't join the dance. I said, remember the iconic images from Tiananmen Square. Remember that guy standing in front of the tank? Well, he was almost certainly killed not long after that took place, along with about 1,000 more students and protesters. You see, this is what governments do. When you do something obvious like that guy standing in front of the tank, you need to realize what their reaction to that is going to be. You need to expect it. You need to understand what the consequences of your actions are going to be. Here's a statement that I wrote over on the badquaker.com forum. It says, and this is in reference to the Kokesh thing, it says, let's review a possible conversation. So we have Adam and a couple of his followers. Adam says, hey team, I'm going to do something that will almost assure that we will be raided and I'll be arrested. So Adam follower number one says, great boss, I'll make sure the house is clean and all firearms and questionable substances are off site. Adam follower number two says, hey, that's a great idea, boss. I'll set up hidden cameras on a separate hidden computer system with upstream backup at a remote site, so when we get raided, we can catch it from every angle. And then Adam says in this pretend conversation, that's great. I'm sure glad I have such a competent paid team of professionals. Now, of course, that conversation never took place. What took place instead was a very poorly planned stunt that Adam pulled. And not long after that, his house got raided, and they were taken completely by surprise, and none of it was filmed. And whether the government planted something or whether they just failed to clean the house properly, one way or the other, Adam is now facing drug and weapons charges, and it's pretty serious. And I would really be surprised if he doesn't go to prison for years over this. I'll be shocked if he doesn't go to prison over this. So what really happened appears to me more like it was scripted by a former life coach for Aaron Hernandez or O.J. Simpson than the scenario that I described. So what I'm trying to say with this is, if you're gonna do something, if you're really intent that you have to make some kind of statement and you have to go out there and just kick the beast right in the knee, if you're going to do that, then you need to recognize what kind of activity this is going to bring up. You need to realize how the beast is going to react and what he's going to do, and you need to be prepared for it ahead of time. Talk to people. Don't just go off and do something stupid. And this is the part, you know, when my kids were little, I had this I told you so song. And this is where I sing the I told you so song. And the way it was, you know, that song, Wimbaway, Wimbaway, I would sing that to the kids specifically when I had said, don't do A, B, and C, because if you do, D will happen. And I would warn my kids ahead of time. And then if they didn't take my advice, and whatever it was, it happened the way I predicted, then I would do this song. I would say, I told you so, I told you so, I told you so, I told you so. And it was irritating, and it was meant to be irritating. But my kids learned from that, that when I would tell them something, it was because it was coming from lessons that I have learned oftentimes by making the same mistake that they were about to make. So it's really critical that we learn lessons from people who have already been through all of this before, that we not just sit and repeat the same stupid mistakes over and over and over. Now, here's a lesson from the 2008 Republican National Convention that took place in St. Paul. There was, out of that, the protesters, not all of them, but a small group of protesters learned a lesson from the 2008 St. Paul Republican National Convention. And they wrote this down, and it's called the St. Paul Principles. And I'm going to read it for you. The St. Paul Principles. One, our solidarity will be based on respect for a diversity of tactics and the plans of other groups. Two, the actions and tactics used will be organized to maintain a separation of time or space. Three, any debates or criticisms will stay internal to the movement, avoiding any public or media denunciations of fellow activists and events. Four, we oppose any state repression of dissent, including surveillance, infiltration, disruption, and violence. We agree not to assist law enforcement actions against activists and others. Now, for us, and this didn't necessarily apply to the people that wrote the St. Paul Principles, but for us, ANCAPs, all of our activities have to adhere to the zero aggression principle and respect for private property. However, it's in our interest to work with others who have similar goals but may not have the same grasp of our principles. We don't have to agree or approve of them in order for us to work with them. We have common things that we can work towards a common goal, and then let the marketplace of ideas sort out the details later on. First, let's get to the goal of what we're trying to get to. Now, there, a different way of looking at this is, I'm responsible for me and you're responsible for you. If or when we organize into groups, those groups should do the same thing. No group should be responsible for the activities of another group. And also, groups shouldn't call out other groups. They shouldn't publicly, put another group on the spot like that. Now, there are exceptions. Rats. Rats are the exception. Rats must be driven from our midst. We must never tolerate rats among us. Rats, snitches, narcs, stool pigeons. Remember, rats spread disease. And we can't have a place for rats among us. And so who would be a rat? Well, let's just say, I was talking about Kokesh earlier. Let's just say, and I didn't. I've never been to Adam Kokesh's house, so this is an entirely, a theoretical situation here. Let's say that I was at Kokesh's house prior to the raid, and I looked around and I saw things, and I saw people, and activity. And let's say I see all these things, and then I come back and somebody says something about it, and then I go publicly on a blog and name names and name specific activities and call people out on what I saw, well, that would be a rat. You see, that's what a rat is. That's what a rat does. Whether you're going straight to the police and telling them about it, or whether you're publicizing these things out in the public, one way or the other, you're ratting out your friend. You're being a narc.
Cough, Cantwell, cough, Cantwell, cough.
And we can't have that among us. That's very dangerous. Now, that's different from being infiltrated. There's always the problem of infiltration anytime you have an organization like this. But like Hess and Wilson said in that one video, and if I can recall, I'll put a link to it in today's show notes. Often, well, although it's like an hour and a half long, but anyway, oftentimes fear of infiltration is more dangerous than infiltration itself. And I've talked before about how we need an above ground movement and a below ground movement. And the above ground movement is going to be infiltrated. It's going to have people in and among it that are not really sincere about it. But what we have to be careful for is the underground movement. Don't worry if they infiltrate the above ground movement. Maybe they'll learn something. But the underground movement has to be absolutely pure. We cannot allow any infiltration whatsoever. And the way to do that is to keep the groups small, no more than two or three per group, and knowing each other very closely. And then you can coordinate these little clusters of groups with each other and accomplish things. But each group has to be very small and very closely knit so that we know who's in it and we know that there are no rats in that organization. These above-ground organizations have to be clean. They have to have no ties binding them to other organizations. That way, if one organization is discredited for some reason, or if one organization has policies that are not acceptable to the other organization, then you don't have anything connecting the two. You can't bring collective guilt onto an organization based on what some other organization has said or what they have done. On the other hand, below ground, we need to connect these different groups, totally diverse groups, even radical left-wing anarchist groups and radical, you know, radical movements that we don't necessarily want to have any association with above ground. We can still connect with them below ground and work towards a common goal. I've said before that our public image has to be no more harmful than Robin Hood of Keene. And if you're not familiar with Robin Hood of Keene, that probably means you haven't heard the other four podcasts in this series, and you should stop listening and go listen to those other four podcasts like I already told you. But the Robin Hood of Keene are people in Keene, New Hampshire that go around putting coins in parking meters that are about to expire or that have expired, saving people from getting a ticket. And then they put a little note on the windshield saying, hey, we just saved you getting a ticket. All right, well, that's totally harmless, yet it's against the law, and they're trying to crack down on it, and they're trying to persecute these people for doing this. And this gives the public opinion that, oh, look, They're harmless. They're just trying to help people not get a ticket. And so this is a positive activity that it's really difficult to look at it in a negative way. It's helping the community. It's helping people. It's in every way. And it's kind of, you know, funny and fun. On the other hand, so that needs to be our public image. But on the other hand, the underground actions need to look a lot more like what was in the movie Fight Club. But keep in mind, no one acts alone, and yet everyone acts alone. Now think about that a little bit, and I can't really explain it a lot more than that, other than to say that, you know, I think I mentioned in one of the other podcasts that the government has perfected this myth of the crazy loner that does something that's just outrageous. Every time that there's a big event, it seems like it always comes back to this one crazy loner. And no, there wasn't a conspiracy. He didn't have any accomplices. It was just the one crazy loner. Well, that's really convenient. Especially if it's not just one crazy loner, if it's a whole network of people that accomplish something and one person takes the hit for it, and there's no connection to any of the others, there's no solid connection, then it can appear as though a person is acting alone and they're just one nut. And the rest of the network doesn't get exposed like that. On the other hand, when you have one person out there doing things, I'll go back and pick on Kokesh a little bit. You know, if I could have talked to him ahead of time and said, or not just me, if anybody with a level head, if he would have talked to anybody and said, hey, I'm thinking about doing this because the other thing didn't work out, so I'm thinking about doing this on 4th of July. Then there could have been a network of people scrubbing his house and setting up cameras and doing all the stuff that needed to be done to prepare for such an obvious event as the raid that came afterwards. So because he decided to go it alone, this is what happened. So we have to learn these lessons, just like the lesson I was talking about with the lady in San Francisco that got her car blown up. We have to learn these lessons. We have to learn what our enemy is like, how he behaves, and how we should behave because of that. There's, of course, we all know that marching on Washington or marching in Washington or whatever is a massive waste of time. We don't want to change government. We don't want to make government more palatable. We don't want to shrink government until it's tolerable. None of those things are acceptable. We want to knock Goliath in the head with a rock and then just run up and chop off his head with his own sword. That's what we want to do. We don't want this thing lording over us one more minute than we have to. And we don't want to make it so palatable that it gets pushed off for another generation or another 100 generations or whatever. We want to put this thing to its end. All right? So I'm not saying that marching on Washington, D.C., is of any value. It is of no value whatsoever. On the other hand, on Sunday, October 13th, 2013, the Million Vet March on the memorials is going to take place at 9 a.m. at the World War II Memorial. And these people, these veterans, are so serious that they have actually already trademarked the phrase Million Vet March on the memorials. Now, in conjunction with that, or maybe totally separate, there's a thing called the Truckers Ride for the Constitution. And this is happening Friday, today, all the way through Monday, the 14th. And the Truckers Ride for the Constitution says, the American people are sick and tired of the corruption that is destroying America. We, therefore, declare a general strike on the weekend of October 11th through 13th, 2013. Truck drivers will not haul freight. Americans can strike in solidarity with these truck drivers. So now, what do we see from this? Well, first off, in addition to the opportunities like Davi proposed in his in the Davi Barker plan, in addition to that, what we see is that there are all kinds of people that are really, really, really upset. And they're all striking at different branches. They're all just out there working their heads off. They're out there risking everything to hack at the branches. But almost none of them see the roots. Almost none of them realize that what they're swinging at up in the air is not the problem. The problem goes right underneath their feet where they're standing. And they never see it. They never look down. They never understand what the bigger beast is that we're facing, this belief in the state. They don't see it. They never understand it. And they just wear themselves out, whacking at the branches. Now, in the midst of all these announcements of all these marches on Washington and protests and everything, there's this guy named Earl Conlon. And he's a truck driver, if the stories are correct. Anyway, so he had made some pretty radical statements about this truck driver's rally thing that's supposed to go on this weekend. And then some of the other truck drivers said, well, that's crazy. We're not going to do that. That's, you know, nobody's serious about any kind of plan like that. Well, then on Tuesday, the Washington Post announced that this whole thing was a hoax. And someone interviewed this Earl Conlon, and he made the comment that all of his comments were designed to do one thing and one thing only, stir the feather of the mainstream media. Now, I don't know anything about this Earl Conlon, and I don't know whether he's bright enough to know what he was doing or if he is, you know, maybe a genius. I'm not sure. But think about this for a moment. What he actually did was by producing what was essentially fake news and presenting himself falsely as the leader of a movement, so to speak, or at least a spokesman for the movement. And by coming up with something, you know, his plan was utterly ridiculous. He was talking about, you know, doing a citizen's arrest on people in Congress, demanding that they follow the Constitution or be arrested. He was talking about holding citizens, what did he call it? Citizens grand juries, and basically sitting court up in Washington, D.C., and starting to try members of Congress. Well, that's pretty much crazy talk, but the media jumped right on it, and it was all over the media that was the plans of these, you know, this massive group of truck drivers that were going to come into Washington, D.C. And that's brilliant. Whether Earl Conlon, however you say his name, whether he's brilliant or not is not the point. That tactic is brilliant because the news media is so vulnerable to false stories. You know, I've talked recently about the evils of the news, of the mainstream media, but one of their great Achilles heels, one of their great weaknesses is that they are so susceptible to really stupid, obviously fake stories. Not only do they generate them, but they fall for them really easily. So you have so fake news. So for instance, a heebie-jeebie epidemic has broke out at a local middle school. That's the kind of, you know, and I'm being extreme, but that's the kind of a thing that that an underground activist can create a stir with it and take away from the legitimacy of the media. Because remember what I've been talking about in these recent episodes about how the media is just an aspect of the state, and it relies upon the legitimacy that people perceive that it has. So how do we fight that? Well, we take away that legitimacy. We show the mainstream media for the liars and buffoons that they really are. And one way of doing that is exactly what this Earl Conlon did. He gave them an utterly ridiculous story, and they bought it hook, line, and sinker. And the more often that people can do that, the more often we can feed fake news to the major news people and get them reporting utterly fake and even silly onion-like news, then the less and less legitimate they become. So that's why I say, you know, here's an example. The heebie-jeebie epidemic has broke out, and it's spreading from school to school. Parents are in a panic. And imagine news releases that go out. You know, Dateline, Denver, Colorado, heebie-jeebie epidemic has shut down half the middle schools in Denver, Colorado. How utterly ridiculous. But if you can adjust this in such a way that the media actually starts reporting it without checking on it, then we've got them. We're showing them for the illegitimacy that they are, and for the laziness that they're guilty of. The other thing that in dealing with the news media, fake police reports can be given to the media. You know, you can have a very official looking guy who's the police captain so and so, and he announces the arrest of a school cafeteria worker who intentionally spread the heebie-jeebie virus throughout the school through contaminated silly straws. And of course I'm being over the top ridiculous with this, but honestly, the media is so gullible, they will buy almost anything. And so if you have a video clip that's really professionally done and looks like local news with some guy who looks like he could be the donut eating chief of police or some police captain or something like that, making a very official sounding announcement with four or five local station looking microphones pointed at him. And he says that they've captured this evil cafeteria worker, and no more will the spread of the heebie-jeebie virus be striking our schools, and sell that thing to the media. Then you have wonderfully hoaxed them and again taken away from their legitimacy. This is the, you know, I was talking about in previous episodes in this series, I was talking about the Lego Brigade and throwing Legos out in the carpet. And this is the news media being an aspect of the state is extremely vulnerable to this kind of a thing. Now, in a little bit more dangerous sense, we see kids, specifically in high schools, are starting to catch on to this. More and more, and I'm seeing this just in local news in Ohio, more and more kids have learned that all it takes is a disposable telephone from Walmart and a 911 call with a fake bomb threat, and a whole school will be shut down, and they get to go home. And that's, you know, high school kids are learning that that's really handy on a specific, you know, on a day when there's supposed to be a lot of testing, or on a day when they're supposed to have a certain project turned in, but they don't have it done yet, or whatever their reason is, whatever the reason is that the kid wants to get out of school, that's a way to do it. Now, that's a very dangerous way to do it, and I'm not saying that that's a good idea, but I'm saying that this same thing of throwing illegitimacy towards the system, using the vulnerabilities in the system to expose its own illegitimacy, and this is something that's catching on among kids, even without anybody guiding them or showing them. Now, this can be extremely dangerous for the kid, because if he's caught, you know, it's just like what I was saying about Kokesh there. A loner making a mistake of going out and doing something radical without knowing what the consequences are going to be is an extremely dangerous situation. But here's something that's maybe a little bit safer than calling in a bomb threat. How about a fake viral video? And Jimmy Kimmel, not long ago, kind of set the standard for this. He made this, they did a very good job of doing a video of this girl dancing and then accidentally setting herself on fire. And it became a viral video. It swept the internet, and everybody just thought, you know, everybody was watching it. Everybody was linking to it. And then it turns out that Jimmy Kimmel had faked the whole thing, and it was a stunt. And that's brilliant, but we can do this too. We can do fake viral videos and use them to discredit the media, the government, specific people in government. Think, for example, you know, I mentioned the fake police captain giving his announcement about the school cafeteria worker being caught spreading the heebie-jeebie virus. Well, what about a viral video from a dash cam of a police car with a cop snorting coke? What about a viral video like that? Or what about a viral video where maybe a couple of cops are discussing something and they use just horrible racial slurs? Or, you know, not long ago, I did a podcast where I was talking about, the Ohio sheriffs and their illegitimacy. And I told about how two sheriffs and Ohio Highway Patrol ended up taking a drunk man, rather than dealing with the paperwork that they were going to have to deal with to arrest him. They just took him and dumped him at a Taco Bell because he didn't speak any English. So their natural, he was Hispanic speaker. And so their natural reaction is to dump him at Taco Bell because the idiots thought that would be someplace where people could understand him. And that kind of racial bigotry that those cops were guilty of, if that all could have been caught on, you know, on a dash cam and then publicized where everybody could get to see it. And it was, in their case, it was caught on dash cam, but they kept it within the, you know, within the court procedures and so forth, and it didn't get out. That's very much like the situation where that one, I believe it was a DEA cop that ended up shooting himself in the foot when he was doing a demonstration to a school, to a classroom full of kids, and he was bragging about how great he was at handling guns and how, you know, what a great authorized person he was to have, this special Glock pistol that he had that was so cool. And then while he's talking about how great, he is, he accidentally shoots himself. Well, that story didn't get out. It was like almost a year after that happened before the story got out and before the video of that got out. But if we could fake things like that and get them out there, just like the news media, you know, essentially fakes things when they very first release them to get more and more hype onto a story. If they can do that, we can do it, and we can discredit them. We just can't let these things be linked back to us. Imagine a viral video of say cops taking a drug money bribe, or of some mayor soliciting a streetwalker. Imagine if we had a fake viral video of that going around. Imagine the impact that would have. Okay, folks, stick with me through the break, and I'll be right back. Okay, thanks for sticking with me through the break. Okay, so now back to going beyond civil disobedience. Are you familiar with the term black bloc? Black bloc is a process that's used in a protest, and anarchists in Europe have gotten really good at this. It's been used in the United States a couple times, been used in Canada a couple times. Black bloc is where you get here's a definition. This is not a complete definition, but it's a partial definition of black bloc. Tactics of a black bloc can include offensive measures such as street fighting, vandalism of corporate property, rioting, and demonstrating without a permit. But mainly, black bloc consists of defensive tactics like misleading the authorities, assisting in the escape of people who have been arrested by the police, and this is in parentheses, unarrests or de-arrests, administering first aid to persons affected by tear gas, rubber bullets, or other riot control measures, building barricades and resisting the police, and practicing jail solidarity. So this is what this is some of the things that black bloc activities include. Now, a good portion of that can be done while adhering to the zero aggression principle and respecting individual property rights. Of course, you know, we can't do like some anarchists do where they just go down the street knocking things over, smashing windows, setting things on fire. That is, not only is that against our principles, I believe it to be counterproductive, but we can do things to support other anarchists and support other groups and other organizations that are protesting or whatever. We can do things to support them without being involved in anything that violates the zero aggression principle and without violating any respect for private property. For instance, we can administer first aid to people who have been attacked by, we can fill that need. That's the kind of a thing that ANCAPs can do and be a part of the ongoing process of what's happening around the world, because more and more riots are going to come to the U.S. They're already happening in a lot of places, Brazil just very recently, and eventually they're going to be in the cities in the U.S. And we can prepare for that. We can train ahead for it. And we can be the kind of support that allows those other people to go on and do whatever they're doing. We don't have to agree with what they're doing. This is what I was talking about earlier with coalitions with these other groups. We don't have to agree with what they're with the tactics that they're using, but we can still support the overall process. We can be the innocent ones that are just there to, oh, look, we're just providing first aid. That's all we're doing. We're, you know, that's the kind of thing that we can do. Even to the point of setting up roadblocks and barricades and, providing misinformation, misdirection. These are things that we can do without violating the zero aggression principle and without, violating property rights. In today's show notes, I'm going to put a couple links to items that are carried at Amazon that might be interesting in situations like this. For example, there are non-metallic zipper pulls that you put on a hoodie or put on a coat or whatever, and you actually open it up, and it's got handcuff keys. There are, and these are non-metallic, one-use plastic handcuff keys. And you can actually, if you're careful, you can use them more than once, but they're pretty delicate. But the idea is that you can actually be searched, patted down, wanded with a metal detector, and this thing goes right through any kind of security. But all the time, you're carrying handcuff keys. And how handy would that be if you're just standing there minding your own business at a distance? You're not a part of the protest. You're not one of those crazy people over there, you know, doing all that protest stuff. You're not dressed in black with a hood or whatever. You're innocent. You're off to the side. You're just trying to get away. You're just trying to get from one side of town to the other or whatever, but not really. Really, you're right there. You're part of it. And you see that person get arrested, and then other people can create a distraction. And you can zip over there and unhook their handcuffs and with a network of people move them quickly away from the police and get them free. And it doesn't matter, necessarily what they're accused of or anything else. It's all part of the process of supporting the bigger thing that's going on. Another thing that's available over at Amazon is a non-metallic, covert zirconia ceramic razor blade. And this can be really handy for cutting those nylon straps that the cops like to put on people. Or for any number of things. Even, cop tires are very vulnerable a lot of times. There's a lot of things that can be done. And if that statement about cop tires shocks you, then again, you need to go back and listen to the first few episodes in this series of Beyond Civil Disobedience. Private property should always be respected by ANCAPs. But there's no such thing as public property. There is no such thing as public property. It's not a concept within ANCAP theory. So then, here's a little story. If you're a fan of the TV show that just finished its run called Breaking Bad, in Breaking Bad, in one episode, they had a really interesting van. And this, what they had done, they took one of those, those giant magnets that they use to pick up, car bodies and put them into the mashers that smash them all down and use that for recycling of the metal. Well, they took one of these giant magnets and they put it in the back of a van that mostly has an aluminum body, like an old U-Haul van or whatever. Now, the trick is you have to have it can't have electronics in it. It has to be old style cars that had, mechanical points and not modern, electronic ignition and fuel injection and all this kind of thing. The old style vehicles that were very, very simple and didn't have all the electronics. Okay, so they've got this giant, magnet in the back of this van. And in the TV show Breaking Bad, they set it up with, dozens of batteries, like deep cycle batteries. But that's a very illogical way to do it. Especially when a generator is so cheap, provides a lot more electricity. And it's not that unusual to have a van with, what appears to be a refrigeration unit, on the van, or you could even have, you could run it right off of the generator of the engine itself. You can create a lot of electricity from the engine of the van itself. You don't need, 75 batteries or whatever in the back. But either way, the idea was to have this massive this massive magnet in the back of this van. And in the TV show, they pulled up to the outside of the building where they kept all the evidence, the evidence room for the police station. And they focused that magnet, shooting right into the evidence room, and they wiped out the hard drive of a laptop computer that was in the evidence room. Well, the same process will work. Let's say if you have a van like that with a big magnet in it, and you can run, you can provide it with electricity. However, maybe don't take my suggestion, but however, you've got electricity to this big giant magnet. And it's pointed, let's say it's pointed toward the passenger side, towards the next lane, in traffic, and you've got it turned off. And so you drive your van around, and then let's say the evil cops have got their Bearcat armed, vehicle. And it's sitting there for display for the city. It's big hoopla and they've got the Bearcat out and all the cops are real happy and they're all taking their picture with it. Well, what if a U-Haul van drives past right at that time and there's some kind of something takes place and all of a sudden the Bearcat, nothing in it works. It won't start. It won't run. The lights won't work. Nothing. Well, the modern vehicles are just packed full of all kinds of very, very delicate electronics and a very large, powerful magnetic field.
Or a microwave generator.
Will just wipe those things out. And so if you had a van like on Breaking Bad, all you would have to do is drive past their Bearcat, turn it up to maximum just as you're driving past it and turn it right back down again. And you just wiped out all their electronics in that Bearcat. Imagine what it would be like taking a midnight drive around a town, around a city, with a van like that. And as you pass, maybe there's a cop sitting on the side of the street, and he's just sitting there eating his donuts or whatever. And as you drive by, all of his electronics just go off, just boom, gone. Think of the potential there. The trick of it is you'd have to switch the truck around now and then to make it look different, because eventually they'd catch on. But think about the amount of Legos in the carpet that would create, as whole cities would have half of their police force, half of their vehicles shut down, and having no idea how this happened. And then think of the fake viral video that could be created to explain it. I can't even go in that direction. Let's go back to Black Bloc again. So one of the things we can do is supply first aid to protesters. We can also transport injured protesters away from the action. How about rolling roadblocks and staged accidents to overwhelm the police during the early stages of a protest? We can provide reconnaissance. We can do that. We can provide reconnaissance. We can be the eyes and ears for the protesters. And again, we don't have to agree with the protesters. You know, I wouldn't agree with these truck driver people what they're wanting to, you know, get back to the Constitution. I have no desire to get back to the Constitution. The Constitution is what got us here. Why would I want to get back to it? We're there now. But we can support these people. We can support what they're doing. We can support the disruptions that they're trying to accomplish. And we can also slowly win them over to our side, because in the marketplace of ideas, we have the superior ideas. Our ideas are far better than the constitutionalists. And as they, if they think of us as just radical nuts, anarchists, crazy people, then they never consider our ideas. But if we're working closely with them, then those ideas spread. I think of what's been done in the food movement of late, in the last 2 years, and really critical people like my friend Eddie Free and a lot of others who have essentially infiltrated them and brought our ideas into their organizations. And more our ideas are spreading, because our ideas of anarcho-capitalism, of the zero aggression principle and of property rights, our ideas are far superior to the ones they held before. So in the marketplace of ideas, we win. And so it's perfectly okay for us to support an organization like these truckers, even though we don't even, or the veterans, you know, what possible connection would we have to want to support a bunch of people who want to go around and glorify, an idol that's been set up to glorify war? Why would we do that? And yet we can. We can go in there and provide them sandwiches and water bottles and if the cops decide to come in, it's too late now. It's happening this weekend. There's no time to organize for it. But let's say the cops were going to come in and arrest a bunch of the leaders of this veterans movement. Well, if we could disrupt them on the way there while staying within the zero aggression principle, then we win. I mean, we have done our part in allowing this situation to win, and we gain the trust and we gain the recognition of other organizations, and we gain more and more legitimacy because of it. And again, that allows us to bring our ideas out into the marketplace of thought and let people examine what we believe. So what I'm saying is the Lego Brigade can sort of, instead of being a black block, we're not going to go out there and set trash cans on fire. We're not going to do that. We're not going to smash windows and turn over cars. We're not doing that. So instead of being a black block, the Lego Brigade can be a gray block. We can be in there, in the trenches, doing stuff, actively letting, on the radio, saying the cops are coming in from this direction, throwing up a makeshift barricade across the street, forcing the cops to take a different direction or to stop and deal with the barricade. All of that stuff can be done within the zero aggression principle while supporting other organizations that we may or may not agree with. So a practical example, let's just say, for example, there's going to be a 420 rally. Well, now, first off, I don't care one way or the other about marijuana. I don't engage in marijuana. I don't use it. I don't have it around me. I don't have it in my house. Nothing. I don't have anything to do with it. But let's say there's going to be a 420 rally in the city park. So you set up a recon alert. Okay, so the alert comes in. The police are gathering at the corner of, let's say, Elm and Jackson, and they're ready to move on the park. Well, right at that particular time, as they start to move on the park, what do you know? There's a minor accident right on their route, right on that street, on the route that they're going to take, blocks the traffic for the whole street, ties up traffic for an hour, 45 minutes, right? At the same time, there just happens to be an anonymous bomb threat on the other side of town. And again, there's real dangers in something like that, because now we're talking felony charges and, you know, inciting panic, and cops get really weird about that kind of thing. But let's just say by chance that something like that happened at the exact moment when the cops were getting ready to swarm in on a 420 rally and make arrests. All of a sudden they can't, because all of a sudden their whole plan is upset and they're all pulled away to another area. Now, so what's the result of this? Well, the result will probably be a far more aggressive police response to the next 420 rally. But remember, every time the beast clutches more desperately and more angrily and more fiercely against people, people more and more realize the presence of the beast. It's through oppression and it's through overreaction on the part of government that people see what government is really like. So either way, it works to our advantage. Either way, whether we're shutting government down or diverting government's attention or making it so the government can't accomplish the things that they brag that they can accomplish, whether we're doing that or whether we're exposing, whether we're angering the beast and exposing him for all the anger and hatred that's in him, no matter which way we take it, we still win in the marketplace of ideas. Think, for example, about the movie. If you haven't seen this, it's worth watching. The movie The Terminal with Tom Hanks. And in this movie, Tom Hanks is essentially almost held prisoner in an airport terminal by silly government regulations. And the longer that he's being held in this airport terminal, the more ridiculous his situation becomes to all the workers that have to be there every day, the whole subculture of low-level workers that keep everything in society running. Well, more and more, day after day, as they see Tom Hanks there attempting to do what he can with the situation he's been dealt, they have more and more sympathy for him. And there's this whole underground network of support that begins to develop for him. Well, those are the people that we need to convince and that we need to reach out to. And these are the people that hold this whole house of cards together. All around the world, it's the workers just going in and doing their daily thing that keeps this all supported. And when more and more of them realize that if they just take one day and don't do their thing, or if they do it, they just do a really bad job of it. Or, you know, I'm thinking of the big NSA spy thing, what the Freedom Fiends are calling the Central Scrutinizer, that big complex out in the Utah desert where they're, you know, trying to listen to every phone call and listen to collect every email and collect every text message and snoop on all the social media and all this kind of stuff that they're doing at that complex. Well, they're having problems with it. Little fires are starting here and there and stuff is happening and they're having technical problems. Well, more and more, if people like us get jobs in places like that, then when you're supposed to be putting in a wire that's rated you know, I don't know. It's like, let's just say a 7-gauge wire. And I don't know anything about this. I'm just making it up as I go. But let's say you're supposed to put a 7-gauge wire because anything smaller than a 7-gauge wire is not going to be strong enough, right? It's not going to be able to handle the load. Okay. So, with wire gauges, a 9 is lighter than a 7 and a 10 is very small compared to a 7. So a 1 is like the biggest and like a 100 would be very, very small. So let's say whatever the prints or whatever the orders call for a 7, well, you put in a 14. Not everywhere in the system, just here and there. You intentionally, in places where you're not going to get caught, you don't do it where there's any possibility that you're going to get caught. And you don't do it where it's any possibility that's going to hurt somebody. But in a big complex like that where you're working for the government and you're building a spy network that's specifically made to spy on American citizens and innocent people around the world, that's the whole purpose of this building, then you got a job in there running wires. You've got the perfect opportunity to put in the wrong wires every now and then. And we see something like this mess that they have there where the thing keeps catching on fire. And yet I have to wonder, you know, I've worked around a lot of government contractors, and there's an old saying that's very common among government contractors, and that is the phrase, well, it's good enough for government work, or it's good enough for G work, or that's good enough for G, and that's the phrase, because it's good enough. It's only the government. You don't have to do a good job. You just have to get it past the inspector, you see? And that's what can bring this beast down. If this is throughout the whole system and everything that the government's trying to build and everything it's trying to do and all the, you know, you think rather than Snowden very famously got all this information out and released it to the public. Well, maybe that's good. Maybe it's not. I don't know. It seems like that was a really good thing. Maybe it's not. But what if he had stayed in there instead and just sent virus after virus into the system until the whole thing was so clogged up that it wiped all, it didn't reveal all their information, it wiped all their information. What if he would have done that instead? What would the impact have been then? Could he have done that and remained, kept his lifestyle and kept safe in America and living comfortably rather than having to flee and leave his family and leave the people he loves and run away to Russia where he's safe? Which would be the better way to go? I'm not sure. I don't know. I don't know. But keep in mind, we don't need a majority. We need a dedicated core with focused action, both above ground and below ground. That's what we need desperately. Now, as I'm running out of time, I want to mention a few things. Some of this I've talked about before, but we need to think about these things, and more so as the future comes towards us. We need to move more and more wealth out of cash and into long-term storage, both on the individual basis for all of us and as our group as a whole. We need to move wealth out of cash and into durable things that are not going to disappear when inflation hits. That can be gold and silver and that kind of thing, but it can also be storable food, remote land, gardening skills, talents. Talents can't be taken away from you just because the economy crashes. We need to learn among ourselves how to hide things, small things, big things, everything from, you know, a bag of rice to a semi truck. We need to know how to hide stuff. We need to know how to build what, if you're in the construction industry or if you're building your own home, you're having a home built, it's a perfect time to build into that places to hide stuff. Because even if you don't need it today in this generation, it will be needed at some point in time. Think of your children. Think of whoever inherits the house. We need to be able to hide people. We need to be able to transport and move people quickly and silently. And we need to be able to hide both people and objects in plain sight, because that's the best way, always. That's the best way to hide something, is right in front of the noses of the people that are looking for it. We need alternative communications and communication networks. I run commercials. I'll put one in today's show. I'll put one in today's commercial. I use a secure telephone. This secure telephone is on a network that is secure, and only people that are on that network can use this phone. And if they know my phone number, then they can call me and I can call them. So I can call anyone on the network and they can call me if they know my phone number. And my phone number in this network, it's a very specific to this network. And these phones are not a whole lot more expensive than regular cell phones, except they only work within this secure phone system. And so that's the kind of thing we need. And I talked to some guys when I was up in Michigan at the Michigan Peace and Liberty rally up there. And they looked my phone over and they took a good look at it. And it's not that difficult to even make your own. The one that the commercial is for in today's show is the one that I use. But even if you're not using that one, it's not that difficult to set up one and make your own network. And these guys in Michigan were looking at it saying, yeah, we could do this. So we need that kind of thing. We need transportation networks. We need anarchist truck drivers and bus drivers. We need anarchist baggage handlers, gate guards, night watchmen. We need to be in these positions, and we need to infiltrate those, not only to get anarchists hired in those positions, but we need to talk to those people and convert them into our ideas. Cab drivers, is a good example. So I want to recap here. Anarchists should, one, educate people on the evils of government, the moral argument. Anarchists should, two, point out the failures of government when government fails to do the things that they claim the exclusive right to do. This is the practical argument. We need to, three, make money from the failures of government, drain government, funneling some of that money back to our cause. And four, we need to assist the government in its path of self-destruction. Don't poke at the dragon. Don't anger the dragon. Don't stand in front of it waving your arms at him and making fun of him. Don't do that. Slowly poison his soup. Folks, thanks very much for listening today, and be sure and get over to badquaker.com, where liberty is our mission. Thanks a lot, folks.